Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Welcome, listeners. Great to have you with us for Thrive Deeper as we actually wrap up the book of Genesis episode, Matt. We're starting from chapter 46 and we're going to close out the book of Genesis. Man, we have covered a lot of territory in this first book of the Bible, and we'll come back and recap on some of that later. But right now we're towards the end of the story of Joseph. And listeners, you'll recall last time that Joseph had been reconciled with his brothers. Pharaoh, because of Joseph's loyalty and incredible work on behalf of Pharaoh, had invited Joseph to bring his entire family to live in the nation of Egypt, given that there was a famine everywhere in pretty much every other country, including Canaan, which is where his family were. So at the beginning of chapter 46, we see Joseph, his brothers have gone back to Jacob. First of all, trying to convince Jacob that Joseph is alive. So Joseph actually didn't go back. He was still in Egypt, but his brothers are trying to convince Jacob that Joseph is alive and for him to come back. And at the beginning of chapter 46, we see Jacob finally agree he's going to go to Egypt.
Yeah, which is a big thing. And so
huge thing.
God speaks to him, says, "I am the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there." And, you know, he says, "I will go down to Egypt with you and will surely bring you back again."
Yeah.
Interesting comment, because they're still getting used to, they're used to territorial gods in a sense. So they're still somewhat getting used to this idea of God being the God of everywhere.
Yeah, right.
And the book of Exodus is going to state that very emphatically, the fact that God is over Egypt. He has complete power over Egypt as well, over the natural realm, over everything. And so, you know, but this is an inductive, they're kind of getting to know this inductively. And I think they kind of know this in one sense. It's not been withheld from them. But, you know, they're learning this. So I just found that statement interesting. I'll go down with you. Now, notice he also says, and I'll bring you back. Now, that's going to be a long time. Now, here's an example of a promise that's going to take a long time to be fulfilled.
Yeah.
You know, this is going to be, depending on how you count it, but it could be a couple of hundred years.
400 odd years.
That's right. Yeah. This is actually how they end up in Egypt, just to draw a line under that. So Jacob and his sons, they go and they settle in Egypt, and it was the famine that takes them there. So, and of course, they're living under Joseph's protection.
In Egypt.
In Egypt. It's interesting that it says, Stu, in verse 27, that there were 70 in all. Just interesting kind of very theological number there to sort of cap off, you know, because there's this sense of it was the sort of fullness of God's promise. You know, this is a clan, and there's something, the number there is indicating something about fulfillment, because this book is so much about fulfillment.
Yeah. So we have there, just leading up to 27, we have just a sort of a list of all of the family, Jacob's family, that traveled back to Egypt, which kind of comes to the end of, as you say, verse 27 of chapter 46. And then we get the arrival into Egypt.
And they settle in the land of Goshen. So Joseph requests this. You know, it says in verse 34, when Pharaoh calls you in and asks, "What is your occupation?" you should answer, "Your servants have tended livestock from our boyhood on, just as our fathers did." This is to prevent them from being drawn into any other kind of service.
Yes.
I mean, I think this is important to you, because Joseph is allowing them to stay separate. Separateness.
Yes.
Is very important.
Yeah, he didn't want them just
Jewish value.
Yeah, assimilate into the Egyptian way of life.
Yeah.
He wanted them to be separate, and he knew that if they came and lived within the main cities of Egypt, then chances are all of their traditions and all of the things that they value are going to be changed, because they're going to assimilate into Egyptian culture.
And so I think it's, you know, in his wisdom, this is enormous foresight on Joseph's part to keep from that assimilation. I think for original Jewish readers, this is an expression of his piety, that he's preventing assimilation here. It goes on to say, "For all shepherds are detestable to the Egyptians." But, you know, it's interesting too that the land of Goshen, it's on the right side of Egypt on the way back.
Yes, correct.
To the land of Canaan. So I think there's foresight here as well, because one of the things that enabled their Exodus, when the Exodus comes, is the fact they're in the land of Goshen that was kind of on the way anyway.
They didn't have to go through the center of town.
That's right.
To get out the other side, exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
So again, you know, very important foresight here. You know, there's this sense that
God's providence, really.
He understands that they've been given the promise of the promised land, of the land of Canaan.
Mm.
You know, Joseph understands this. This has been passed down. And so, you know, I think he's thinking forwards to that. Another indicator of his piety and his faith.
Yeah. And let's remember that was one of the things that made it difficult for Jacob to leave, as you said, why going to Egypt was a big thing, because they were in the land of Canaan at that point in time. And he was being asked to leave.
Exactly.
This is where we're meant to be, but we're going to Egypt.
That's exactly why it takes God to speak to him to say, no, you can do this. Because otherwise Jacob's think, I have to be here.
Yeah, that's right.
This is where God wants us to be. So they do go down. Now, it's interesting, Stu, in chapter 47, even having said that shepherds are detestable to the Egyptians, Jacob has this audience with Pharaoh. Not only does Jacob have an audience with Pharaoh, but it says twice, listen to this, then Joseph brought his father Jacob in and presented him before Pharaoh. Now, this is the most powerful person
in the world at the time. Yeah.
And Jacob is a small shepherd clan leader. He is an absolute nobody.
Who the Egyptians detest because he's
that's
a shepherd.
Right. Now, of course, Joseph is not a nobody.
No,
Joseph is, you know, has been elevated. So that means something here. But it goes on to say, and it's kind of a passing comment, Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh asked him, how old are you? And he goes on. And then Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my pilgrimage are 130. My years have been few and difficult, and they do not equal the years of pilgrimage of my fathers. Then Jacob blessed Pharaoh, it says,
and went on
from his presence. Interesting that it's not the other way around.
Yes.
You would think it would be the other way around because Pharaoh's, you know, saw themselves as kind of demigods, really. This is an important covenant moment here. I mean, I know there's a sense of age and there was definitely a sense of
honor, kind of
honoring those who were older. But still, this is Pharaoh.
Yeah.
And he is, in a sense, the father of all of his people. So to accept blessing from this shepherd, I think, is a remarkable moment and probably a recognition that with Joseph, there's something about their God and their connection with their God that is important here. I mean, the fact that they're in the midst of something that was quite a remarkable revelation of God, and Pharaoh was in the midst of benefiting from that, and he hasn't forgotten it.
Yeah.
So, and that means something. This is the ancient world, right? That really means something.
Yes.
So I think he's sensing, man, there's something on this people, and so I think this is part of what's happening here. And, you know, for the writer of Genesis, this is a moment of fulfillment because God had said to Abram, through you, you know, the ends of the earth will be blessed. It says of Joseph that all of the ends of the earth came to Joseph for food, right? So that's one kind of blessing. But here we have Jacob blessing the most powerful man on the earth and him accepting that blessing from him. You know, I think that's important. Now, This is going to turn bad in a couple hundred to a few hundred years, depending on how you count that.
But of course,
curses are going to come on Egypt because they're going to enslave the people. But right now,
and in the
we know that it didn't have to be that way.
And in the immediate, as we continue to read the story out, we see that Pharaoh indeed was blessed. You know, because of Joseph's.
So, actually, as it goes on, as the account goes on, and this is into chapter 47, we get a little bit more detail about Joseph's, you know, wisdom and shrewdness, his managerial skills. Because as the famine goes on, they come to buy food. Now, they run out of money and so they sell
all their livestock first.
They sell their livestock first and then their land and then what have they got? Then they basically sell themselves.
Yes.
This was a common way of, you know, paying debts. You could sell yourself into
as a bond servant.
As a bond servant. Mm. Now, you know, there's some debate over what kind of bond service was this? Could they eventually buy their, you know, pay this off? Probably they could. And I mean, there's a little bit, it's interesting in reading about this, and I read a few different perspectives. Because, you know, one perspective is that, and I think this is the right way to see this, and perhaps I'll read from the JPS commentary, which is Sana, who's a Jewish. This is a Jewish commentary.
Yep.
On this, the severity, it says, of the remaining years of famine is such that the people become wholly dependent on the state for survival. Joseph rises to the occasion and averts disaster through a series of dramatic measures that in effect nationalize the land and livestock and turn the populace into tenant farmers of the state. So, you know, Sana sees this as a positive thing. This is his wisdom at work. Some commentators see that, you know, has Joseph gone too far here? Is this maybe part of what brings on the trouble later on? The memory of this, perhaps, I don't know.
Well, at the end of the day, they're going to starve if they don't do something.
They are. And look, I feel like the majority of commentators came out in seeing this as an indication of Joseph's wisdom. And and at the end of the day, what we do see in the text is that they willingly accept this. I think the text presents this in a positive light, that they're happy to have the opportunity to save their lives.
Yeah.
But also, it's meant to convey the fact that because Pharaoh promoted Joseph, Pharaoh himself became enormously powerful and wealthy. You know, and that's, you know, it was the same with Potiphar's house, you know, and so forth. They prospered because of who was in their midst. And So what we end up with here in the end is that all of the land is nationalized. So it all becomes crown land, to use that term.
Yep.
And
apart from the land of the priests.
So they're tenant. Apart from the land of the priests. Yep. I mean, they're suitably superstitious to not mess.
Let's not do that.
Not mess with that. Yeah. You know, the priests were also quite powerful in these societies. You don't want to mess with them too much.
Well, it's like hedging your bets, isn't it?
Yeah, you're hedging your bets. The priests are going to come up against you in the book of Exodus. They're going to be important characters there as well, but we'll get to that. So it ends up with all of the land owned by the state or the crown, Pharaoh. They're tenant farmers, and it's interesting also that Joseph organises that as they farm, they're to give 20% back, a fifth.
Well, he gave them the seed first. That's the first point. So they didn't have anything to grow. He gives them the seed and says, here, this is for you to grow, but here's the deal.
Yeah. And I think that's portrayed here as quite a generous deal.
Yes.
You know, they're tenant farmers. You have 80%. I just want the 20% back. Now, I think this is an important backdrop, again, for the Mosaic Law.
Yes.
Because the contrast in the Mosaic Law is that God gives them the land for a start. So, but there's a sense in which it is God's land and they are tenant farmers in a sense in the promised land.
Yes.
But of course, God requires not 20%, but 10%.
Yes.
So he is that much more generous in that sense. So the law of tithes, which was a very important principle of acknowledgement of God, principle of worship, and that is stated in the fact that it predates the Old Testament law. We see this with, you know, with Jacob and then back with Abraham paying tithes to Melchizedek. You see the same principle essentially at work in the New Testament church, although they're giving, well, essentially sharing
everything
you know. And so, you know, it's an important principle, but I think it's interesting to note how while Pharaoh's asked, you know, 20%, and that seems reasonable because they're tenant farmers, God only asked 10%. And that even that, I mean, at the worst times in Israel's history, as in the time of Malachi, you know, even that becomes an issue. And Malachi's point is it got this bad that you can't even do that? You know?
Yeah, exactly. So the Israelites then settle in Goshen. Which is the land of Egypt, as we said. They acquire property, so it would seem that maybe they can buy, as they earn money, they can start to buy land back. And Jacob, of course, lived there with them for another 17 years until he was 147.
And it says in verse 27, they acquired property and they were fruitful and increased greatly in number.
Which is going to be important too.
This is going to be important. And it's going to become a problem because, and this is the interesting thing about this story, Stu, that God blesses them and blesses them. I mean, we've already seen this at points in the story. We saw this with Isaac, you know, for example, that God blessed him so much. And Jacob actually, when God blessed him so much and the people of the land said, listen, you
need to go somewhere else.
Go somewhere else, because this sense they're becoming too powerful. So this blessing, dare I say it's a mixed blessing? I mean, it's a, God is blessing them, but it's going to cause problems with the people around them.
But there's purpose in that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
This is part of the setup for what's going to happen in the book of Exodus.
That's correct. Awesome.
Yeah.
So then Jacob senses that it's time for him to, well, he's getting older, and he wants a promise from his son Joseph about what happens to him when he dies.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously he wants to be buried away from Egypt, wants to be buried back in their essentially family burial place.
Yeah. Which is interesting, isn't it? I mean, they're living in a pretty good situation,
yep,
under the favor of Pharaoh. It's like they've moved to the outskirts of the big city, right?
Yes.
I mean, the land of Canaan, at this stage, it's a little bit of a nowhere.
We left there.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so, you know, so you'd think, we'll settle here. But you see, there's this ingrained consciousness that this is where we belong,
yes,
right? The promised land,
yeah,
is where we belong. And him asking to be buried there is an important, I think, for both Joseph, as we've seen, his recognition that
he knows what he heard from God. Yeah.
And the sense that Jacob, you know, to be taken back there is still driving this connection,
yeah,
with the promised land, which is so important for this story.
So Joseph takes an oath to do that, of course.
Yeah.
And then as time goes on and Jacob's getting older, he sent out his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. When Jacob was told that his son Joseph had come to him, Israel, Jacob, summoned his strength and sat up in bed. He's obviously getting fairly old. His eyesight's pretty weak at this point in time,
yeah,
147. I think my eyesight would be pretty weak by then too. And Jacob then speaks to Joseph and kind of recounts the promise to Joseph to make sure that Joseph understands what, yeah, God has promised in relation to the land of Canaan.
Yeah. Yeah. And then essentially he, and it's a strange one, but Jacob adopts Joseph's sons. And this is, I think, a way of promoting Joseph, really. It's kind of recognizing, promoting his particular family line, in a sense. Although, as we'll see, the tribe of Judah actually becomes quite important in when Jacob declares the son's futures, which is an interesting prophetic,
yes,
sort of thing.
Yes.
The tribe of Judah becomes important. Now, we know what happens with the tribe of Judah, of course.
Yeah.
But Manasseh and Ephraim, actually, as time goes on, they actually become the two biggest northern tribes. I mean, the northern, yeah, kingdom of Israel is going to be enormously powerful,
mm,
powerful enough to split away from
the southern kingdom.
I mean, this is future history.
Yeah.
But they are the two biggest tribes, essentially. And in fact, often the prophets, when they speak about the northern kingdom, they sometimes refer to it as Joseph or Ephraim.
Yes.
So Psalm 80, hear us, O shepherd of Israel, it says, you who lead Joseph like a flock.
Mm.
And Psalm 80 is a lament over the destruction of the northern kingdom. It's interesting, yes, that it refers to the northern kingdom as
Ephraim,
essentially Joseph.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But often also it's referred to as Ephraim.
So the northern kingdom, just we've covered this in previous episodes, obviously, was Israel. The southern kingdom was known as Judah. So this is in future history. So,
yeah.
But coming back to this, this is where they come in. And
well, actually, to connect that, if I may make a connection, Stu.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting that northern kingdom, that Ephraim seems to always have the preeminence, because Ephraim is the younger of the two.
Yeah.
And it seems to be recognized well into the future,
mm,
that in some sense Ephraim is the dominant, well, of all the northern tribes. But hang on, what about Manasseh? He's the oldest, right?
Yeah.
Well, of course, we've seen this
thing
throughout. And it's a remarkable and an important pattern, because God's favor is by grace. It's not earned through natural right. The text is always upturning any sense of natural rights. You don't have natural rights.
Yes.
You have divine grace. And so God invariably favors the younger over, mm, the older.
Mm.
And we see Jacob reflecting this when Joseph brings his two sons to his father, who's a little blind right now, and he puts his right hand, which is important symbolism, on Ephraim's head and his left hand on Manasseh's head. And Joseph thinks, oh, the poor old blind guy, he's got it wrong. And, mm, he goes to take his hands and swap them over, right? Because the one on your right hand is the most important one.
Yeah.
But Jacob says, no, no.
No, 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 this is right.
No, it's the younger one, mm, is the one that's going to be preeminent. So yet again, you get this flipping. And of course, Jacob himself had benefited. Jacob was the younger of the two brothers, Esau and Jacob.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, Jacob actually crossed his hands to do that. So yeah. It's like it was not just a simple mistake. It was very intentional.
Very intentional.
But Joseph thought he'd made a mistake, as you said. And
Joseph too, who's now the preeminent son here, he's the second youngest himself. So
yeah. So then Jacob blesses Joseph, of course, and then talked about the blessing on the boys. And may they be called by my name, which is where you're saying he kind of adopts them, and the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow to be numerous within the land.
Yeah, and nevertheless, he says his younger brother will be greater than he when he's talking about Manasseh, and his descendants will become a group of nations. So he put Ephraim ahead of Manasseh. So again, the text is very emphatic about that because this has been an important theme. And again, I just to really put a line under this, the biblical value here, and let's see this, any sense of natural rights or entitlement is washed away in favor of divine grace. This is what's happening here, because the whole rest of the story, a central part of the rest of the story is going to be that your status, the favor that you enjoy, the promise is given to you, not by right, but by grace.
All right, then we get on to Jacob's last words to his sons, obviously. He calls his sons together and gather around. I will tell you what will happen to you in the days to come. And there's some interesting stuff in here, Matt.
Yeah, well, you were saying off mic, you're a bit surprised. He's a bit hard on some of his sons. Well, look, Stu, the relationships had been a bit fraught.
Yes, well, of course.
Haven't they? I mean,
Reuben.
Let's just start with Reuben, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
Reuben had slept with one of his father's wives, and that is about as bad a thing as you could do. So, you know, there are pretty fraught relationships, and from there down, you can kind of assume that things have
not gone great.
You know. So we've got the family of promise, the family of blessing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean everything's rosy in this family.
It's dirty dozen.
That's right. It's the dirty dozen. All right. It's interesting that he says, gather around so I can tell you what will happen to you in days to come, right? Mm. So he gathers his sons. Or imagine what they're thinking. I mean, first of all, it's significant because Jacob is playing a prophetic role here. Okay. Yes. So this is interesting. This is new, right? Mm. This is the first... Apart from what God has declared over certain people, this is the first time you have a person playing a prophetic role. So here is Jacob declaring and sort of, you know, predicting where things are going to go. He says about Reuben, turbulent as the waters, you will no longer excel, for you went up to your father's bed and onto my couch and defiled it. So it's pretty hard on his son. This is, by the way, Stu, I know, yes, this does kind of seems harsh. You know, wouldn't you on your deathbed be
trying to find the positive?
Yeah, trying to find a positive.
Maybe there wasn't any.
No, but see, this was seen as making things right.
Yes.
And you sort of you see this further on when David on his deathbed, he does a very similar thing.
Yeah, he does,
this is a cultural expectation. You don't leave loose ends. You know, justice has to be done.
Yeah.
And so David instructs his son Solomon, make sure you deal with this person, deal with this person.
And there are even people that he'd forgiven before.
That's right. Yeah, he's forgiven, but
he's
there's
a risk.
Been an injustice, right?
And therefore
he's a risk. So he's tying up the loose ends. Mm. So this is part of Jacob's kind of tying up the loose ends, and because he didn't do anything about Reuben's sin against him, which was very, in that culture, is in. Basically, it's supplanting your father. I mean, it's essentially wishing your father was dead.
And that little thing, he got into my bed at the end of verse 4, makes it sound like maybe none of the other brothers know. So he's kind of going, he got into my bed. You know, it feels like he's kind of making sure everyone knows his flaw in that. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their knives are vicious weapons. May I never enter their council. May I never join their assembly.
Now, this is Levi's. This is the tribe of Levi, they think, that are going to become the tribe of priests.
Yes,
right? And he says, cursed be their anger so fierce and their fury so cruel. So remember the thing about the Shechemites when the violence against the Shechemites was, Jacob wasn't happy with that.
No, that's right.
It was just overreach, absolute overreach, far more violence that he says, you've made me a stench in the nostrils of the people in the land, right?
Yeah.
We've got to live with these people.
Yes.
We live here. So that comes back to get them here. So they don't really get away with that in a sense. Now, it's interesting, Judah, I was thinking about this, Stu, because I don't think Judah comes out of this story as being much better than his brothers. In fact, there's the story about Judah and Tamar.
Yes.
Which I think clearly shows that he's not no better than his brothers. And yet Judah receives a remarkable promise here.
Mm.
Your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. You are a lion's cub, Judah. This is the tribe of Judah and the connection with the lion, right? The lion of the tribe of Judah.
Yeah.
You return from the prey, my son, like a lion crouches and lies down, like a lioness who dares to rouse in the scepter. This is interesting. This is a very important promise now, Stu. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until he to whom it belongs shall come.
Yeah.
The obedience of the nations shall be his. So not only will Judah be the tribe from which the promised kings, God had promised Abraham, kings will come from you. Specifically, they will come from the tribe of Judah.
Judah.
I mean, this is interesting because when we get to the story of David, whenever we get to that, stew in times to come, we will get there. You know, Saul was from the tribe Benjamin, right? So so there's, I think, part of Saul's insecurity there, perhaps in the light of this promise, it was understood that the tribe
of Judah was the ruling one.
I've been watching, by the way, little footnote, I've been watching The House of David. It's on Amazon Prime. I was so impressed with what they did. I loved it. A great biblical adaptation,
okay.
I reckon.
Worth a watch.
Yeah, worth a watch. I think they do a great job with the story. So, The House of David.
He's getting ahead a little there.
I'm not. Jeff Bezos did not pay me for that.
Now, I think that's important here. In my translation, I'm not sure if it's the same in yours, it says, until he whose right it is comes, as a capital H, I think pointing towards Jesus.
Yeah.
And the obedience of the peoples belongs to him with a capital H, which I'm again assuming is pointing forward to Jesus, the tribe of
Judah. For a start, this is written in Hebrews and there's no capitals. But I think what your translation, which is the CSB.
Christian Standard Bible.
Yep. I think it's giving us a hint there. And I think it's right.
Yeah.
I think it's the right hint because it clearly says the scepter will not depart until the one comes who was going to rule over all the nations.
Yeah.
Now, that's everyone. So this is undoubtedly a messianic prophecy right at the, you know, right at the start of the Bible. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because we started the book of Genesis with a messianic prophecy in chapter 3. You will strike his heel, but the seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent, right? Of the seed of the serpent.
Mm.
So there's a messianic prophecy there. And it's interesting, your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. So there's the sense of crushing the head in that sense.
Yes.
But also this promise of essentially an eternal kingship here.
Yeah.
So.
And it goes on to say, he ties his donkey to a vine and the colt of his donkey to the choice vine. He washes his clothes in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth are whiter than milk.
Yeah. So we have the rest of the brothers, and I think on the whole, the older siblings probably get the harshest deal here. You know, Zebulun is going to live by the seashore. It's interesting because the land allotments haven't been done yet, but the land, tribal land of Zebulun was on the northern coast.
Issachar.
Yeah. So it goes through Issachar. We won't go into these.
Dan was an interesting one. He will be a snake by the road, a viper beside the path that bites the horse's heel so that its rider falls backwards. I mean, if I was Dan sitting there and my dad is about to die, I'd be going.
Yeah, the tribe of Dan has an interesting history in what follows. They're going to be guilty of some very serious sins as a tribe. It's up in the tribe, up in that area that the golden calves are going to be set up.
That's
in the northern kingdom of Israel. Jeroboam's going to put the golden calves up there. You can you can visit the ancient village of Dan, one of the key villages, and where the altar of those calves actually are. You can go there to this this day.
And those were there to save the people having to travel to Jerusalem, to the southern kingdom, when things were starting to get tense.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting too, in the tribal list, this is where we get to who are actually the 12 tribes. There's a lot of confusion around that and slightly different accounts. But it's interesting when you get to the book of Revelation and, you know, when there's 12,000, the 144,000, there's 12,000 from each of the tribes.
Yes.
There's one tribe missing and it's a tribe of Dan. So they're not counted in that. So just an interesting fact. Maybe we'll talk about that When we get to the book of Revelation.
Revelation, which is not far off.
Which is not far off.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll hold on to our hats for that one.
We will. Joseph, he goes on to say towards the end, Joseph is a fruitful vine beside a spring. Its branches climb over the wall. The archers attack him, shot at him, and were hostile toward him. Yet his bow remained steady, and his strong arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, by the name of the shepherd, the rock of Israel.
Yeah. So essentially, the language here is the language of blessing, because your father's God who helps you, because of the Lord Almighty who blesses you with blessings of the sky, blessings in the deep below, blessings of the breast and womb. Your father's blessings are greater than the blessed. So it's blessing, blessing, blessing.
Yes.
Because he is the one that's really carrying this blessing. Of course, that's what his dreams essentially indicated, that he was going to be the one chosen by God. Again, it's the younger, not the older, that was going to carry the covenant blessing forward. So, and then Benjamin is blessed as well, but briefly, Joseph, gets the longest section here.
So then we get Jacob's burial instructions, and essentially, again, this is where he's pointing out that he wants to be buried in the father's cave in the field of Ephron, the Hittite, which he'd purchased. We may remember he purchased that from the Hittite.
Yeah.
And Abraham and his wife Sarah were buried there. Isaac and his wife Rebecca were buried there. And he buried Leah there.
So there's quite a bit of space given to this, you know, make sure you bury me there. Because the emphasis here is on going back to the promised land.
Yeah.
And that's a very important emphasis, because that's part of God's purpose moving forward. So this shows their zeal, their alignment with God's purposes still, even though they're in Egypt. The writer of Genesis is casting our eyes forwards to the promised land.
Yeah.
So verse 12, so Jacob's sons did as he commanded them. They carried him to the land of Canaan, and they buried him in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre.
Mm.
So Joseph gets permission to go. Pharaoh says, I'll send you a whole bunch of soldiers to go with you, probably to protect, probably also to make sure that he comes back as well.
Okay, yep.
Because he kind of needs Joseph there and wants to make sure he comes back. Now, when Jacob dies, Stu, the brothers think, right, because they're thinking this is too good to be true.
Yeah, well, this is this justice thing.
Yeah,
you were talking about
justice thing.
Okay.
Yeah, they're expecting this.
Yes.
They're expecting that now that Jacob's died, that surely, he's instructed Joseph to, come on, you've got to get back at your brothers, perhaps, or at least they're expecting, because people don't forgive, you don't forgive.
No, right? not that.
So they're naturally expecting, so he was obviously just waiting till our father died, and now he's going to get back at us.
Mm.
Whereas Joseph emphatically says, no, I'm not. That's not how it's going to work. And the rationale is really important to
hear
here in
verse 19. Chapter 50, verse 19.
But Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? That is such a important statement.
I'm not here.
I'm not your judge.
Yeah.
That's just a vital statement. Yeah. Put a line under that. That's an important one. Then verse 20, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. That's such a significant statement.
Yeah.
And he's made it before. He said this to them before, but he reaffirms this here. He accepts what happened to him as part of God's purpose. He went through this terrible, terrible experience, but he needed to go through that experience in order to save other people's lives.
Yeah. To be that where is, God wanted them to be.
That's the meaning of life right there. This could be in the New Testament. This is what life's all about. Like you might need to carry your cross and follow Jesus for the sake of saving many lives, because it's what Jesus did. There's so much Christological significance
to
this statement, because ultimately the same message would be given to the Jews by Peter in Acts chapter 2. Listen, you intended this for evil, but God has used this for good, and it's actually for the saving of the whole world.
Yeah.
And so I think it's wonderful that the book finishes on that note, and then we have the death of Joseph, and he says, I'm about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Joseph made the Israelites swear an oath and said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place. So Joseph died at the age of 110. Mm. And after they embalmed him in Egyptian fashion.
Very unusual for Jewish people to be embalmed, though. So it was quite unusual for a Hebrew or Jew to be.
And
be
look, I mean, but again, he was a high official in Egypt.
I was just going to say, again, it kind of highlights the fact of how important he was considered to be to the Egyptian people.
So the book finishes, Stu, with this forward look. We've got a picture here, the big picture of this book. And I think reading this again, I was so struck, really quite impacted, Stu, by the big picture of this story. Yeah. Because through the fumblings and the machinations, and even at times the lack of faith, the outright disobedience and evil deeds of the people of promise, yet God brings about his perfect purpose and him working through these very imperfect people who were not always faithful, but God was always faithful along the way. And even the fact that bad things happen to those people, but that in some senses becomes a part of God's purpose in the mystery of God's providence.
Grace,
and the Joseph story in particular is a kind of microcosm of the story of Israel, maybe even the story of God's people in the world.
Yes,
Stuart,
you
know, I mean, casting forward, we mentioned the book of Revelation. There's a connection with that, you know, the sense of the embattled church and the, and yet, you know, while curses are coming upon the world, yet there's the saving of a multitude and rejoicing in heaven. And, you know, this sense in the midst of the strife of this world, God's purpose is absolutely unstoppable. Yeah. The book of Genesis in this beautiful way anticipates everything that's going to follow. Mm. God is going to choose very imperfect people and they're going to mess up. I mean, we see the story of the Old Testament, the story of Israel, they do look very much like their namesake. The story of Jacob is remarkably, including his exile and out into Laban and all of that sort of stuff. And he says that his life was troubled. You know, he says that to Pharaoh, I've lived troubled. And yet he sees the faithfulness of God, right? Mm. Yet he sees the faithfulness and blessing of God. And he becomes this link in the chain of God's purpose, a vital link in the chain of God's purpose. There's so much about that that speaks to our lives and the purpose of our lives. And I think ultimately that looks forward to the time that we're in. And I'll finish with this, Stu, because, you know, the promise to Abraham was that through him, blessing would come to the ends of the earth. And I think this story finishing with Joseph, who was mistreated and sold into slavery, given over to pagans by his brothers. I think ultimately it prefigures the Messiah, Jesus, who would come, who would be handed over by his brothers to pagans, who would suffer, and yet who would bring, as a result of that, what was intended for evil, God intended it for good. And because he bore that suffering, blessing would go to the very ends of the earth. The reason we're sitting here doing this today is because of that faithfulness of God.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.